people power.
Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the political divisions within the Iranian ruling elite made apparent by the rebuke to President Ahmadinejad, who on the eve of his trip to the United Nations announced the release of two Americans held captive, only to be overruled by the Supreme Leader. Nader Hashimi, the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future, joins us. Then we'll get an update on the euro crisis from Matthias Venengo, professor of economics at the University of Utah, who's just returned from Geneva, where he was working for the UN Development Program. We'll examine the paradox of developing countries like China and Brazil propping up the sick economies of Europe and the United States, as well as try to find out whether the Europeans will get their act together before the eurozone crashes. Then finally, following the recent defeat of the pro-Israel Orthodox Jew running for a safe Democratic congressional seat, who was defeated by an even more pro-Israel Republican TV producer of the Jerry Springer Show, we will look into whether the perceptions that Republicans are more staunch allies of Israel than Democrats will play out in the 2012 election and affect what is expected to be a close presidential race. MJ Rosenberg, who worked for 15 years on Capitol Hill for a number of congressmen and senators and used to work for AIPAC, joins us. I'd also like to invite you to the Hammer Forum I am conducting next Wednesday, September the 21st at 7 p.m., America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda, co-presented by Penn USA. The two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times correspondent Eric Schmidt and national security expert John Mueller join us to discuss the war on terror. Eric Schmidt covers terrorism and national security affairs for the New York Times as the co-author of Counterstrike, the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. And questioning the costs and strategy is John Mueller, author of Terrorism, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. Again, next Wednesday, September the 21st at 7 p.m. It's free to the public, the Hammer Forum in Westwood. Hope you can join me. Let's now talk about the apparent divisions within the ruling elite in Tehran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nader Hashimi, who is a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and the co-editor of the new book, The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nader Hashimi.
Glad to be with you.
And clearly the Iranian leader, if indeed we can call him the leader, has been rebuked, if not humiliated, on the eve of his trip to the United Nations. He promised the release of the two American hikers still held, and that was reversed. So give us a sense of what explains this division and dysfunction at the top of the power structure inside of Tehran.
Yeah, well, there are essentially two political camps within Iran's conservative establishment that have been at each other's throats since the spring of this year. There has been this sense that the camp of Ahmadinejad and his chief of staff have accumulated too much power, that they are trying to take Iran in a somewhat different direction, and the camp of his critics, which revolve around the office of the Supreme Leader and in particular Iran's judiciary, are trying to send a clear message to Ahmadinejad that power resides in the office of the Supreme Leader and that he has to be subservient to the wishes and whims of the office of the Supreme Leader. And so there has been this back-and-forth battle between the two camps that has now resurfaced in the context of these two American prisoners who were supposed to be released today, but it seems like their release will not take place until sometime in the future.
But this is not the first time there's been an excuse for either some kind of public rebuke or humiliation, or at least the appearance of a political excuse to get it at Ahmadinejad. I mean, his chief of staff has been a source of dispute. Now, apparently, some connection, however tenuous, to a massive amount of bank fraud is being used against him. Give me a sense of who's got the kind of tools, if you will, the political tools to win this kind of battle, because it seems to be being fought in many ways in a kind of Karl Rovian fashion. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, the people who have the political tools and the power to put constraints on the office of the presidency, Ahmadinejad and his camp, is really the office of the supreme leader and sort of more hardline, ultra-conservative elements of Iran's political establishment. And so you're correct. Charges are being brought up against Ahmadinejad and his staff for embezzling funds, for engaging in bank fraud, for promoting a deviationist interpretation of Shia Islam, for trying to take Iran down a different path. And so there has been these back-and-forth battles. Arrests of close allies and supporters of Ahmadinejad have taken place. And so what's supposed to happen next week is Ahmadinejad is supposed to travel to New York. And he has used these international trips to accumulate a lot of public attention, both globally and within Iran, to present himself as this regional leader who's standing up to the great superpowers. And he uses that international attention that he gets when he travels abroad to shore up support back at home. And so on the eve of this trip to New York, I think his critics in Iran, who are really centered in the office of Iran's supreme leader, are trying to humiliate him. They're trying to prevent him from scoring a public relations victory by having these American hostages released before he arrives in New York, and by making sure that they're not released before he arrives in New York, it complicates Ahmadinejad's foreign trip, because the first thing he's going to be asked as he gets off the airplane is what's the status of these American hostages. And that's a conversation he does not want to have. He wants to talk about other issues that he can win PR victories.
So, Nader Hashemi, again, professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. I understood that one of the real powers here behind the scenes is the son of the supreme leader, who I believe was in the Revolutionary Guard Corps with Ahmadinejad. And what's the connection there? Have they had a falling out?
Well, see, yeah, no one really knows. I mean, in over the last 2 years, since the crackdown on Iran's pro-democracy movement, the son of the supreme leader, a man by the name of Mujtaba Khamenei, has emerged as this individual who apparently has played a very important and instrumental role in terms of presiding over the crackdown against the pro-democracy movement, and also sort of being his father's sort of go-to person, the person who really is running the office of the supreme leader, where most of the power is concentrated in Iran. Now, as to his relationship with Ahmadinejad before, in terms of their affiliation or connection when they were both in the Revolutionary Guard Corps, I think no one really knows for sure. That took place many decades ago. To what extent they had a close personal working relationship or not is unclear. Even the figure of the supreme leader's son, there has been no serious, I think, study or analysis of exactly what role he's playing exactly. They're just sort of rumors and innuendos, largely because, you know, Iran's political system is deeply authoritarian and access to information, particularly at the upper echelons of power, is very hard to come by. So no one really knows for sure, but there are these consistent reports and rumors that come out that, you know, this young man, the son of the supreme leader, is playing an increasingly important role in really sort of running Iranian politics, guiding Iranian politics, and leading the charge against Ahmadinejad and his camp.
So when you say that he's accused, Ahmadinejad and his camp are accused of being a deviation in Shia Islam, we know that he's a 12th-er, as they call it. He believes in the hidden imam's return, and apparently does so fervently. And sometimes when he comes to New York, he says some strange things about, I was surrounded by light, and all of these references to this sort of messianic interpretation of Shiism. But I thought that was, you know, that would be shared by the supreme leader. So where's the deviation?
Yeah, well, you're correct. It is shared by all sort of factions, political factions in Iran. The difference is the role that clerics should play in Iranian politics. The Ahmadinejad school of interpretation, which is known as the Iranian school of Shia Islam, have been articulating this new interpretation of Shia Islam that downplays and sort of denigrates the role that clerics should play in contemporary society. And that's the main point of difference. There is this sense that Yes, we all believe in the final 12th Imam who will return at the end of time. Since we know that is certain, we don't really need clerics to intervene in the interim. We have a sense of what the future will be like. So it's really an anti-clerical interpretation of Shia Islam that Ahmadinejad's chief of staff, who is really the Karl Rove figure here behind the presidency, who has been the focus of a lot of attention and a lot of criticism from the other conservative camp located in the office of the Supreme Leader.
Well, Nad Hashemi, I imagine that this would play well with the public, doesn't it? Aren't the public pretty disgusted with the mullahs? I mean, they've essentially taken over all of the mansions in North Tehran that the Shah's cronies had. They've taken over the foundations. They're basically the new parasites, aren't they?
No, you're correct. I think, and that's actually the deliberate calculation that is taking place. There is an attempt by the camp of Ahmadinejad to sort of draw upon the deep-seated anti-clericalism that exists in Iranian society, particularly among young people and the middle class, who are upset at the state of politics in Iran and blame the clerics for the crisis of state and society, and they're trying to draw upon it and appeal to that sentiment within society to say, look, you know, if you vote for us in the parliamentary elections, if you back our policies, we will, you know, promote a new agenda that that is more progressive, that is less encumbered by the intervention of the clerics, and this is the way forward for Iran's future.
Well, of course, it's a bit of an irony, isn't it, Nad Hashemi, that Ahmadinejad's the good guy in this, given the kind of press he's gotten internationally and the things that he said that have inflamed so many people.
No, it is ironic. It's ironic, but one has to keep in mind, you know, Ahmadinejad is a good guy only in the following narrow sense, when the two choices are between his camp and the camp of the Supreme Leader. But I think those are, you know, false options. There is a third option here, and that's the Green Movement. So, you know, one has to have a broader perspective. But yes, interpreted narrowly between these two rival camps, there is this sense that Ahmadinejad, at least, you know, has a different interpretation, a less clerical interpretation of religion and politics that he's trying to advocate. But it's pretty clear where the power lies, and that he has been forced to sort of tone down a lot of his political desires. And if one follows events over the last 3 or 4 months, the office of the Supreme Leader is the one that has asserted itself, and that is really, you know, winning this internal factional rivalry.
Let's broaden out then to the foreign policy landscape. The former head of Saudi intelligence, former Saudi ambassador to the U.S., had an op-ed piece in the New York Times this week that was very, very strong and very terse, warning the United States not to veto the Palestinian statehood, both of which are inevitable. He went on to suggest that the winners would be Iran and Syria. It's pretty clear that Iran is on the defensive about losing the Assad regime. They've sent about $7 billion to prop it up. They've sent in al-Quds people to help them crack heads and murder Syrian citizens. There's a split now between Hamas and the Syrians and by extension the Iranians over what's happening in Syria. Iran seems to be poised for a huge foreign policy defeat. And curiously enough, the United States, who's the, you know, obviously a main antagonist here, seems ambivalent about this. What's your interpretation of it?
No, you're correct. I think what's happening regionally, across the region, is that the Saudis are trying to interpret the Arab Spring as an attempt by Iran to expand its influence in the region. And it's trying to appeal to the United States and the West that if they're not careful, Iran can take advantage of opportunities to expand its influence. And so, you know, a lot of things are changing as we speak right now. And, of course, the big question here is the future of Syria. If Syria undergoes some sort of regime change, and I think we're still a long way from that happening, then, of course, everything is up for grabs in terms of the future political regional alignments and forces that might emerge victorious. You're correct. Iran stands to lose a lot of influence regionally if Syria, if the Assad regime goes under and it's overthrown, because that has been Iran's major ally in the region. It's the main conduit for Hezbollah and Iran's relationship with Hezbollah. So the Saudis, I think, are jockeying for position here. They're trying to, I think, they have come out recently and supported strongly criticism of the Assad regime, hoping that if that regime can go under, some sort of Sunni regime can take its place that will be more favorable to the Saudis than to the Iranians. The United States really, I think, isn't a factor in this debate. I think they're really trying to play catch up here. Over the last several months, a lot of things have changed, and everyone is sort of jockeying for position here. But the key, I think, variable is really the future of Syria. The future of Syria matters much more to the future of the politics of the Middle East than let's say, the future of Tunisia or Libya, which is somewhat geographically distant from many of the more centered and emotionally charged conflicts that revolve around the Israel-Palestine conflict, Iran's relationship with the region, Saudi Arabia's relationship with the region.
Well, it's no secret, though, surely, Nader Hashemi, that the Iranian appeal has been based upon their notion that we are the ones that will deliver freedom to the Palestinians and, by extension, defeat the Israelis. And that is their appeal to Islam, that we're the guys that are going to deliver Jerusalem, Al-Quds, you know, and they're suffering setbacks, as I mentioned, with their surrogates in Hamas because of what's happening in Syria. So it seems to be a moment where the U.S., you think they'd be doubling down, but they're not. And I'm just wondering whether the Palestinian statehood issue is going to play into the Iranians' hands, because the U.S. is not going to look good.
No, I think the Iranians are going to try and exploit that. If there's a veto of the resolution, either at the Security Council or at the General Assembly by the United Nations in any sort of alliance with European powers that reject the notion of a Palestinian state, the Iranian regime is going to take that to the bank and try and reinforce the argument that the West is structurally, ideologically opposed to Palestinian national rights. And I think the United States is actually very cognizant of that. That's why they don't want this vote to go to the Security Council or to the General Assembly, because it'll make the United States look very bad at the same time where Obama is trying to reach out to the Islamic world, has given a speech on May the 18th supporting the Arab Spring and the idea of freedom and self-determination. And so how do you square that with, you know, opposing self-determination for the Palestinians? So I think, you know, the Iranians actually are hoping for a veto at the UN Security Council or at the General Assembly. But the larger term picture here is, I think Iran is very nervous about the future trends in the Middle East. If, for example, democracy takes root in Egypt and Egypt reasserts itself as the voice of Arab and Islamic sort of nationalism in the region and starts to champion the rights of the Palestinians, well, that makes it much more difficult for the Iranians to do so. And so the idea here that somehow Iran is going to be a victor because of the Arab Spring, I think is one interpretation, one that I don't put a lot of stock in, because of these sort of developments for democracy and self-determination. There's also the Turkish factor here, and I think we should mention that, because as I speak, the Prime Minister of Turkey is in Egypt, and he's going on to Tunisia and to Libya, and he is really the sort of the voice he's a very popular voice and a popular politician now within the Arab world because of his outspoken position on the plight of the Palestinians, because of the fact that Turkey is an emerging democracy and a vibrant economy, and he's portrayed as sort of a model for the Arab world. I think that also worries the Iranians in many ways, because they want to be the voice of the oppressed and they don't want anyone else to usurp that position.
Right, while they're oppressing their own people. I mean,
Well, that's the irony of all of this, right? Iran claims to be, you know, supporting, at least rhetorically, the democratic revolutions in the Arab world, while at the same time crushing those same revolutions at home.
And the choice between the Iranians and the Saudis is a pretty dismal one. So little wonder that the Turks are looking good. And, of course, the Turkish prime minister, in terms of the Palestinian statehood, said it's not a choice, it's an obligation.
Right. No, and I agree. And I think the Turkish position here is much more in keeping with sort of basic principles of international law. It's a better model. I mean, among the rival sort of states, if you compare Turkey, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, the Turkish position is one that I think is more defensible and one that I think presents a better model for the future of the Arab world. So absolutely, I agree with you on that point.
Well, it's odd, though, that the Israelis have managed to offend everybody. They turned down the Saudi peace offer, which apparently offended the Saudis, and they're having a spat with Turkey. And they clearly have limited the ability for President Obama to do much. Nobody can lean on the Israelis. Look what just happened in New York. A safe Democratic House seat was lost over the issue of Obama or the Democrats not being sufficiently pro-Israel.
No, I agree. I think one of the problems here is that because the United States has wholeheartedly backed Israel for such a long time, effectively giving the Israelis a carte blanche to do whatever they want, there is a sense of arrogance and entitlement that the leaders of Israel have toward the politics of the broader Middle East and toward their relationship with the United States. There is a sense that they can do whatever they want and there won't be a heavy cost to pay. So now you're starting to see some of the consequences of this sort of one-sided ideological position manifesting itself. Israel's relationships with Turkey are going down the drain. Israel's relationship with Egypt now is very strained. And its relationship with the Palestinians and the rest of the Islamic world has gone from bad to worse. So I think we're really headed toward a crisis moment. The sad thing here, as you alluded to, is that the Israelis are not going to, I think, unilaterally change course unless there's some pressure from their closest ally, the United States. But of course, the United States and the Obama administration, according to my interpretation, is not going to take any serious measure to put pressure on the Israelis to agree to international law and to agree to a two-state settlement because of domestic American politics. There's a sense that, you know, if Obama next week vetoes at the United Nations a resolution on Palestinian statehood, that will be good for him when it comes to next year's presidential election.
Well, just in closing, Ahmadinejad is coming to the United Nations bearing gifts. He's bringing, I think, 1,000 copies of a book that he's put together entitled Documents on Iran's Occupation by the Allies During World War II. I don't quite know what he expects from that, but that's apparently his gift to the world.
Well, that's the first time I'm actually hearing this, but I'm not surprised at all. I think, you know, Ahmadinejad is going to use this trip to shore up his own sagging reputation back at home, and he's going to try and get as much media attention as possible. I'm willing to bet that he's going to invoke again the question of the Nazi Holocaust. He's going to say provocative things, and he's going to try and get maximum sort of exposure and attention on this trip so that he can take it back home and hopefully revive his own sagging political fortunes.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Nada Hashimi.
A pleasure to be with you. Take care.
And again, I've been speaking with Nada Hashimi, who is a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of a new book, The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the Euro crisis.
The Bible's blood and Torah's death, the Quran is new. If you burn them all together, you get close to the truth still. They're pouring over Sanskrit under Ivy League moons while shadows lengthen in the sun. Cast on a school of meditation built to soften the times and hold us at the center of the spiral lines. It's knocking over fences, crossing property lines for winds.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marius Fernango, who is a professor of economics and Latin American studies at the University of Utah. He has recently returned from Geneva, where he was working with the United Nations Development Program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marius Fernango.
Oh, thank you for having me. Yeah.
And strikes me as a huge irony, Marius, that, and you've been working for the UN Development Program, that this paradox of that it's the developing countries like China and Brazil, apparently, that are propping up the sick economies of Europe and the United States.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, there is an ongoing, dual recovery, two-speed recovery. Developing countries growing relatively fast, given the circumstances, and apparently, stagnation in Europe and in the U.S. So, at the end of the day, it has to do with the fact that developing economies are actually, or at least did, through the recession. First of all, they weren't as financially, exposed. Levels of debt were not that high, And also they did expansionary fiscal policies, so they were able to recover relatively fast. While exactly the opposite apparently is going on in the developed world.
So where does it stand with Europe? I keep trying to get a handle on the euro crisis, and speak to people fairly regularly. George Soros is over there now. He had put out a very stark warning recently in the New York Review of Books. Does the euro have a future? He ties the problem systemically to the crash of 2008 and Lehman Brothers, and since then they've substituted sovereign credit of governments for bank and other credit. He seems to be extremely worried. The finance ministers are meeting tomorrow in Poland. They keep dressing up this Greek situation. Greece is really in default, isn't it? I mean, can't they? They don't seem to be able to handle it, or at least get past it without, smoke and mirrors.
No, the second bailout is, it's doomed to fail as the first one did, and it's doomed exactly because they're reproducing the same policies. Tim Geithner and Christine Lagarde, ahead of this meeting tomorrow, have said that the solution, which I think it's part of the solution, it's not the solution, but certainly part of it's recapitalizing the banks in Europe. So, accepting the fact that those banks that are holding in their books lots of, periphery bonds, particularly Greek bonds, are going to have to suffer losses. So I think that's a given. And in that sense, the default is, more or less acknowledged by Tim Geithner and Christine Lagarde, the managing director of the IMF. So I would agree with that. I want to say something about the origins of the crisis. I think it has to do... There is a parallel with U.S., but it's slightly different, and it goes beyond 2008. The crisis in Europe has to do with the U.S., for example, the last 30 years or so, wages have not increased, productivity has increased, labor productivity, but wages have stagnated, and people were able to continue to consume and, the economy to grow fundamentally because they got indebted. So higher levels of debt and bubbles, dot-coms and, mortgage, subprime and so on and so forth, is what allowed the economy to expand even though wages did not expand. In Europe, there is a slightly different story, but, wages have not increased, in particular in the central countries. So in Germany, wages have stagnated too, although productivity has grown. And what happened is that the German economy has grown on the basis of exporting to the peripheral countries. So their wages do not grow, their productivity grows, but wages grow and allow, a bubble of consumption, if you want, in the periphery of Europe, allowed for a while the whole economy of Europe to grow. A lot of that's very similar. So in countries like Ireland and Spain, it was like in the U.S., also associated to a housing market bubble. In the case of Greece, a little bit more of government spending because the rates of interest when they got into the euro were really low. But fundamentally, I should say, it's like in the U.S., it was a private sector boom, a bubble, debt-led boom that led to this collapse. And so... Now, that mostly, banks were rescued and, we keep rescuing them all the time. This is sold as is equivalent as in the U.S., as if this is a government problem and that the need is for fiscal adjustment so that, fiscal contraction, should be the solution out of that. And so I think that's the origin of there is a problem of the European imbalances. The fact that Germany, being the central country, should be the one pushing, the economy of Europe out of the recession, and apparently the European leadership, including the German, Angela Merkel, she said today that euro bonds are off the table, are unwilling to do that, and I think myopically, don't see the dangers of what they're doing.
Sure. Well, that seems to be, by the way, Manny Svenenga, that is what Soros is pushing very hard on the euro bonds, and he basically saying that the German public still thinks that it has a choice between about whether to support the euro or abandon it. And he's trying to say there is no choice. He's also talking about, in terms of the Greeks' situation, an orderly default and temporary withdrawal from the eurozone may be preferable to a drawn-out agony. How do you deal, you know, because those two situations, I think, are pretty key to this crisis, aren't they? The German public thinking that somehow it has a choice here, and everybody's sort of collective delusion that somehow this Greek default is not as real as it is.
I agree. I mean, as we talked, you know, the previous time, I think that disorderly, you know, default in the case of Greece is way worse than say something like you know, a disorderly default in Argentina in 2002. You know, this Greece is, you know, part of a whole community of countries that are, you know, involved in the euro. It will have consequences for Spain and Italy and for the whole functioning of the European economy. It will also have, you know, if it hits hard, which it should, you know, yesterday Moody's downgraded a bunch of important French banks, you know, Societe Generale and others. And
Credit Agricole and PNB, yeah, exactly. Also. Yeah. So what about that? What happened today, though, Marius, where the European Central Bank, acting in cooperation with the Federal Reserve of the United States, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and the Swiss National Bank, pumped a whole bunch of dollars into Europe. What's that likely to do?
Well, that's good. I mean, in all fairness, you know, the ECB has the ability to do it by itself. The ECB could be buying bonds of, you know, Greek bonds. And so even if they don't create euro bonds, the ECB last month bought Italian and Spanish bonds, and they reduced the spreads. They should be, you know, be aggressively buying Greek bonds and Spanish and, you know, and other peripheral country bonds to reduce the spreads and make it easier for these countries to refinance and get out of the hole. So from that point of view, I think that's this was an important step in the right direction. You know, that they try to, you know, create lines of credit for banks there. What, you know, it's a bit frightening about this whole story is that there is no commitment to do it on a regular basis. So it's as if, you know, I mean, the ECB, you know, Trichet, the Jean-Claude Trichet, the head of the ECB, and his likely successor, you know, now the Italian name escapes him, but they have been very clear that, you know, they don't, you know, they don't think that buying peripheral countries' bonds, unless they do violent, you know, extreme fiscal adjustment, is acceptable. So it's a quid pro quo sort of situation. Here I should say something, you know, that part of the study, you know, we wrote while I was there in Geneva, the UN, it's the so-called Trade and Development Report, which was published earlier this month, shows, you know, that over the last, you know, two decades, and we could have said three decades if we looked at Latin American debt crisis too. But if you look at the crisis that came with the Asian, you know, countries in the late 90s and the current crisis, and we looked at 17 IMF fiscal adjustment programs, so not very different from what the IMF with the ECB is doing in European countries. Systematically, the IMF adjustment programs fail to produce the actual fiscal consolidation. So the fiscal accounts got actually worse, and they did not deliver growth, with two exceptions. The two exceptions are, you know, Russia, that defaulted in the 90s, and Iceland, that defaulted right now. But the point here is that not that default is a solution necessarily, is that the fiscal adjustment is not a solution. So default in per se will not solve the problems of Greece or the European countries. The other big risk is if this country, if these banks in, you know, France and Germany go down, they're holding huge amount of credit default swaps, which are still around, and this may contaminate the whole world economy. So not only, you know, they may bring down Europe, but they may bring down the U.S. even further and affect international financial markets to such a extent that even developing countries, China, Brazil, you know, Argentina, or the countries that, South Africa, the countries that have been growing could be thrown into also, a recession, like in 2008 with, Lehman Brothers.
Well, but presumably that's one of the reasons why China and Brazil are pumping money into, to try and stabilize Europe. But just again, Matthias van Enge, who's a professor of economics at University of Utah, just returned from Geneva, where he's working with the United Nations Development Program. Just to focus in on the problems here, we've got a north-south divide in Europe. We've got governments that are too slow to act and markets that are too fast, and they're short selling like crazy. They smell blood. That's just the way it is. Then you've got these deep disagreements on how to prevent the problems of Greek debt from undermining the common currency. One of the best solutions, at least it seems so, was the euro bonds. The Germans have just Merkel's just shot that down. I mean, this feels like fiddling while the euro is about to burn.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that the reasons for not using euro bonds, I think, are quite weak. The notion that there might be a risk of inflation, it's preposterous. There's no reason to believe that Europe is close to any sort of inflationary pressure from the demand side. In fact, the news today is that Europe, basically, the estimates for the fourth quarter is that it will basically stall close to zero, so not even half. So Europe basically stalled. It's not growing. Germany is not growing, I should say. So it's not like, it's just in the periphery. Greece will fall by 7%, if I'm not wrong, this year, GDP. So it's, it's a catastrophe. But Europe as a whole is not going to grow. So the risk of inflation are, very reduced, to say the least. And the other is moral hazard, the notion that this will create a situation in which they'll permanently be forced to run deficits to bail out, the peripheral economies. To some extent, I don't think that that's also a significant risk. I think that this should be seen. I think Jamie Galbraith said that, in a column a few weeks back. This should be seen from the point of view of European history as something equivalent to the failed attempts to, at reconstruction in the south of the U.S., which was finally achieved during the New Deal. So during the New Deal is that several programs, of spending, federal government spending, in rural electrification and farm subsidies and whatnot, did allow the south eventually to catch up with the north and in the U.S. And I think that, that's the way it should be seen in Europe too. So this should be seen as an opportunity for providing significant transfers for the South and to bring them on a sustainable basis, to convergence with the North of Europe, but not on the basis of, bubbles of consumption, meaning, in the building of, common infrastructure and in the building of sustainable, jobs in the South so that they don't have to migrate in order to get better jobs and so on and so forth. In all fairness, I should say, European elites don't seem to be there. So whether they will have the ability to reach an agreement or not, it's at this point, unlikely.
Yeah, but I don't think the markets are going to show any more patience. If they don't make an agreement tomorrow, it would seem to me that things could really, there could be a serious run, surely. I mean,
sure. One thing that I read yesterday that got me really concerned is that Mario Blecher, who was the head of the Argentinian Central Bank in at the time of the default, in fact, and before that a long time career economist of the IMF. PhD in Chicago, so certainly no radical. He said that he thought that Greece should default. He's an advisor to Mervyn King at the Bank of England these days. He said that they should default. So if insiders of financial markets, people that normally frown upon the notion of defaults as bad things, suggest that the default is the only acceptable solution. So that means that a lot of people think that now, given that they're incapable of providing an orderly default, so they might have to live with a disorderly one. Again, there is a danger implicit in that. There is a danger that they may throw the whole, world economy into a tailspin. So it's not necessarily, as much as I said the previous time, look, the euro is not a sacred cow. So for the people of Greece, it has proven to be not particularly good. So as much as convertibility, dollarization in several places of Latin America, but it's not obvious that the alternative will be good for everybody.
Well, the alternatives would be to create a European treasury, but that won't happen overnight. So it seems to me that either they let Greece go, or they get their act together, which they seem incapable of. But the latter seems to be more dangerous, and that's what troubles me.
Yeah, no. As I said, it's perfectly agreed. It's a very it seems increasingly likely scenario.
Yeah,
I'm sorry to say so.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Matthias Venango.
Oh no, thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Again, I was speaking with Matthias Venango, who's a professor of economics and Latin American studies at the University of Utah. He was recently in Geneva, where he's working with the United Nations Development Program. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the Jewish support, or the Jewish vote, will be affected by the Republicans claiming to be stronger in their support of Israel than the Democrats, reflected in this recent race.
Against them, we found our own reasons to sing, and it's so much less confusing when lines are drawn like that. When people are either consumers or revolutionaries, enemies or friends, hanging on the fringes of the cogs in the system. It's just about knowing where everyone stands. All of a sudden, people start talking about guns.
And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and joining us now is MJ Rosenberg, who's a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, focusing on foreign policy and Middle East affairs. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years. Previously, MJ Rosenberg served as the director of policy and analyst for the Israel Policy Forum, and was an editor for Near East Report, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee's APAC biweekly publication on Middle East policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, MJ Rosenberg.
Thanks, Ian.
And this race in this New York congressional district that's in both Brooklyn and Queens, where there are three Democrats registered for every one Republican. A pro-Israel Orthodox Jew running on as a Democrat was defeated by an even more pro-Israel Republican TV producer of the Jerry Springer Show.
So, yeah, crazy.
Go figure.
This district is, I'm from the district, and it is totally unique. It's one of the least Democratic districts, if not the least Democratic district in the whole city of New York. It is, it's 40% Jewish, but of that 40%, a disproportionate number are Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox Jews, or Soviet, former Soviet Jews, Russian Jews. These people always vote, are Republican, and they have, they pretty much switched over when Giuliani was mayor, and they all like Giuliani, and they're very hard line on Israel. They're not typical of Jews anywhere. There's probably there's no other district like that in the country. I mean, there are segments of, sections of, West LA that are similar, but this is a large population that's very conservative. So, and then, okay, then you have them, and then you have a
the Republican himself is from the large Irish Catholic, a very conservative Irish Catholic enclave in the Rockaways, which is right on the beach. And they're usually Democrats, but they're Reagan Democrats. They're those kind of people who are uncomfortable with a lot of things. They vote Democrats, because their parents did, but they're not real Democrats. The important thing to remember about these, both the Orthodox Jews and Roman Catholics, and that's pretty much most of the district, they didn't like the Democrat's stand in support of gay marriage. He's an Orthodox Jew, David Weprin, in the state legislature, but he voted against the Orthodox Jewish and Roman Catholic position in favor of Governor Cuomo's position in support of legalizing gay marriage. That counted for a lot. So there's Israel, there's gay marriage, and then you have the general, Obama's not real popular. So, the economy's bad. People don't necessarily understand why. It was an opportunity to vote against the way things are going now.
So, speaking of Obama's lack of popularity, in 2008, he got 80% of the Jewish vote. And in a recent poll a month ago, it was down to 60%. Now, right. What about the Republican Jewish Coalition? They sent out these mailers, including one from Mayor Koch, a former mayor and a Democrat, talking about the Democratic candidate David Weprin. It might very well cause President Obama to change. In other words, to urging a vote against him. It might very well cause President Obama to change his hostile position on the State of Israel to reestablish the special relationship that presidents before him have supported. What is the evidence of Obama having a hostile relationship to Israel?
It's absolutely absurd. I mean, I have to say, as someone who's a big supporter of the two-state solution and of a Palestinian state alongside Israel, I am totally disappointed, as most of my friends are, in the fact that Barack Obama has maintained the completely identical policy as George W. Bush. We're having that vote, there's going to be a vote in the UN, on the Palestinian state. He is going to, cast a no vote, isolating us from the rest of the world. I don't agree with Obama's policy on Israel. I think it's bad for Israel, bad for Palestinians, and bad for the U.S., but I would characterize it as pretty hard right on Israel. This guy, Ed Koch always had problems with Obama. He's an 85-year-old, essentially he's a crotchety guy who's, I guess I can say this, he's never been particularly comfortable with African Americans. I mean, the fact of the matter is, it's not a big surprise he doesn't like Barack Obama. And as the guy has gotten older and older, he's become increasingly parochial, the whole world wants to kill the Jews. That's not really typical of most Jews. When they show them, 78% of Jews voted for Obama. And maybe, in fact, his popularity is down to 60%. But has anyone said analyzed, and the answer is no, whether or not the numbers have dropped because Jews are disappointed by the fact that he isn't the kind of progressive they thought they were voting for? I mean, let's remember who this population is. The Jewish population is one of the few populations in the country, segments of the population in the country, that favors paying higher taxes for more social services, that's always out there for social issues, and many of them, in fact, most of the ones I know, I live in Chevy Chase, Maryland, which is a pretty, liberal, kind of posh suburb of Washington, D.C., lots of Jews here, and most of the people I know are disappointed in Obama, not because he's too far, because of Israel, but because they don't see him standing up for progressive values. Jews have always been the most pro-progressive, among the most progressive people. If not, they're certainly the most progressive segment of the white population. So I'm not sure it's Israel at all. And in the New York Ninth, I just think it's an anomaly as a district.
Sure. Well, the guy, but it may well be that, you know, not just the weakness of the Democratic candidate David Weprin, but it seems like the Ackerman and the other guy whose district joins it sort of wanted this MOOC to run because he's going to be that district's going to be absorbed by them. They didn't want to
exactly. They picked him because they thought they didn't want their district to be the one to disappear. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, they obviously didn't pick the strongest candidate. But I you know, I don't know. The right before the, okay, I've mentioned on your show before, right before the 2008 election, the American Jewish Committee did a poll. And there they do the most expensive and biggest poll that anyone does of a population survey of the Jewish community on what issues matters to Jews when they vote. And they happen to be a very conservative, very, you know, pro-Israel organization. When they analyzed, the findings were that only 3% of Jews, 3 to 4%, the exact number was 3 to 4% cast their votes based on Israel. Number one was the economy, and taxation was like 51%. Then came like the environment and, you know, all these other issues. And then you had number seven with 3 to 4% was Israel. So, I mean, and that certainly goes along with the experience of, you know, I'm a Jew myself who cares about Israel and has been there many, many times. I don't know people who think that Barack Obama is anti-Israel. But then again, I'm not an Orthodox Jew or a Russian Jew. I'm much more typical of, you know, someone, you know, of American Jews. I just don't see it. Most American Jews do not think of Israel first when they vote. Even if they care deeply about Israel. We have never had an anti-Israel president. Mm-hmm. The policies of this country have been consistently pro-Israel. I mean, it's like a joke.
Right.
You know, calling an American president anti-Israel. Every one of them has backed policies that were pro-Israel. The Republicans want to use it to divide and conquer. It's not going to work. Obama may not be that popular among Jews, but it's not about Israel.
So you think the Republican Jewish coalition, the idea that they might be able to peel off enough votes, you know, it's obviously going to be a close election, a presidential election. I don't think there's much doubt about that. So that's kind of a pipe dream. But
I don't know about, you know, 80-year-old voters in Florida.
Sure. Well, that's what they're counting on. They're moving down to Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, thinking that this strategy has just worked for them in New York. But of course, you know, your other point, just in closing, MJ, is that Obama is going to veto the Palestinian statehood. It's going to be a terrible, terrible for America's position around the world, but it's going to be good for him with the Jewish vote. At least
the thing is, those people and the Republican Jewish Coalition, the neocons, AIPAC, that whole crowd will not give him any credit at all.
Sure.
They're just like the right on everything. No matter what he does, they will say he's anti. I mean, that's why I think he should do the right thing and support the resolution. He's not going to get these people's support anyway.
So,
you know, I live in a dream world, so forget it.
Well, thank you for joining us here, MJ.
Thanks, Ian. Great. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with MJ Rosenberg, who is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, where he focuses on foreign policy and Middle East affairs. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years. Previously, he served as the director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of Near East Report, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with a specialist on Iran because the Iranian president, Ahmadinejad, who is just is coming to the UN next week, and just before he left, he announced the release of two American hikers held captive, only to be overruled by the supreme leader. So clearly this rebuke or humiliation indicates some kind of power struggle going on inside of the ruling elite. So we try to look into that to figure out what's going on there. And it's a sort of an odd situation because Ahmadinejad is a pretty dreadful guy, said some outrageous things. But compared to the supreme leader and the crazy, even crazier crazies than he is, they all believe in the hidden imam and, you know, this messianic interpretation of Shia Islam. But apparently the difference is that Ahmadinejad doesn't believe in the power of the clerics, that you know, that individuals can be just as pious and they don't need to be told how pious they have to be by religious authorities. And this apparently plays well in Iran because of the enormous corruption associated with the clergy, who are just a bunch of parasites who've just replaced the Shah's cronies, moved into the same mansions, you know, grabbed the same foundations, and living, you know, off the fat of the land. So that's the game that's going on. But of course, there's the third choice, which is the Green Movement, which these the Iranian regime has been suppressing, and they're trying to claim some ownership of the Arab Spring. And I guess they're also very heavily invested in the Palestinian statehood issue, which, of course, the U.S. is going to come out looking bad on that one. Then we talked about the euro crisis, which we're just trying to find out, get some clarity on this thing, because obviously Greece is in default. And it's obvious that the Germans somehow think that they can have it both ways, you know, in terms of being in the Eurozone, that they have some kind of choice. And the longer that they dither, the worse it's going to get. So Matthias van Engo, he's just back from Geneva, where he'd been working for the UN Development Programme. He also pointed out the incredible irony that it's the developing economies of Brazil and China that are bailing out the Europeans and the Americans at the moment. So go figure. But he basically felt that that they should let Greece go, that it'd be worse to sort of continue the agony. But he's very skeptical that the Europeans can get their act together. And tomorrow, Friday, that is, they're supposed to, the foreign ministers meeting in Poland. And frankly, after that meeting, if nothing is resolved, and obviously it's not going to take, you can't overnight create a kind of European treasury. That's the disadvantage they have. They don't have a common currency, but they don't have a common treasury, and a common reserve like we have with the Federal Reserve. So this could end up, being a trigger for not just a double dip recession, but a depression, which is really why I've been trying to stay on top of the story. Then finally, we did an analysis of this race in New York, where a pro-Israel Orthodox Jew was defeated in a safe Democratic seat by a pro-Israel Republican TV producer, The Jerry Springer Show. But MJ Rosenberg used to work for AIPAC, as a matter of fact, and a lot of congressmen. He said it really doesn't reflect anything on a national level, and that most Jews are fairly liberal and they don't vote about Israel. They vote about other things. And he thinks that the Republicans are kidding themselves, that they can win a lot of votes. But he also thinks that Obama, should stand up to them and not kowtow to Israel, which, of course, is not going to happen. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.